Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. We are just a few weeks into the new year, and we can't escape one maddeningly stubborn problem.
The deadly toll of gun violence is again our top story tonight.
Another mass shooting claiming lives in California.
11 people were killed in Monterey Park, California.
Well, sadly, we are turning now to another shooting. This one at a nightclub.
Word of another mass shooting in California, this one in Half Moon Bay.
There have already been at least 39 mass shootings this year. That's according to the Gun Violence Archive. One of them has struck a particularly emotional nerve because of the circumstances. It happened in Monterey Park, California, a predominantly Asian American suburb, at a dance hall on the eve of Lunar New Year. Both the gunman and his victims were of Chinese descent, and we don't know his motives, but the attack nonetheless sent shockwaves through Asian American communities around the country where people just frankly have already been on edge for a few years. To learn more about Monterey Park and its history, we called up a scholar who grew up nearby. James Zarza Diaz is a professor of history at the University of San Francisco, and he's the author of the book Resisting Change in Suburbia, Asian Immigrants and Frontier Nostalgia in LA. And James, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So you published an op-ed in the LA Times in response to the shooting in Monterey Park, and I really was moved by the way you opened the column. You wrote, "For thousands of fellow Asian Americans, Monterey Park is our home, even if we don't live there." Just to start us off, what do you mean by that?
For me, you know, for a lot of Asian Americans, what happened in Monterey Park was really triggering and painful. And we're still obviously working through all of this and processing things. But because, again, of the familiarity of the landscape, Monterey Park really embodies how a lot of Asian Americans live today, with single family homes in suburbs. But there's a bit of a, you know, twist to that dimension in the sense that these strip malls are not necessarily mom and pop shops owned by white families or rows and rows of mainstream American chains. But in this case, places like Monterey Park are dim sum restaurants, boba shops by the dozens, you know, Buddhist temples, along with Christian churches. And that space of where the crime happened and the violence occurred is especially, you know, familiar to children of immigrants whose parents and elders go to places like dance halls and social gatherings like that.
Let me ask you about that.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I have to say, like, I am one of the people who I learned about Monterey Park as this majority Asian American community through this horrible news. And I detest that that's how I came to this, to this place. And one of the odd moments of, I don't know if the right word is joy, but that I get when I was reading about it is the vision of these dance halls. Mm-hmm. And can you say a word or two just to like help us place this in joy? Like a word or two about the role these dance halls play in the Lunar New Year?
Absolutely. And I think, and this is why, you know, what happened is so personal and resonates with a lot of Asian Americans, is these dance halls are places of joy, as you said. They're places, you know, where revelers come together, right? And in this case, it was because it was Lunar New Year, it was especially, you know, boisterous and fun and presumably loud and exciting. But even apart from the Lunar New Year weekend, These dance halls are spaces of gathering community. My own mother goes to places like this where she meets up with a bunch of her friends around her generation. And a lot of them are retirees or people who, you know, are empty nesters, and they just want to have time with their friends and their loved ones. And they go to these dance halls where all kinds of music are played. Sometimes these dance halls are more ethnic specific, so it caters to Chinese, it caters to a lot of Korean or Filipino immigrants or Filipino Americans or Asian Americans, broadly speaking, right? But oftentimes these spaces are, the predominant community are immigrants, right? And refugees, and oftentimes multi-generational. So that's why, you know, when we think of these dance halls, they are places of joy. They are places of excitement and caring and love and all of these things. And I think that's why it especially hurts, right? What we heard about Monterey Park.
Yeah. Monterey Park has been called an ethnoburb. That's a term a lot of us are learning for the first time as a consequence of this awful news story. So what is an ethnoburb?
Ethnoburb is basically a suburb that has a large concentration of a specific ethnic or racial group. And that can be measured in a variety of ways. Oftentimes, it's just population size, right? Do you have a plurality, a majority of typically non-white groups? And so Monterey Park is, in many ways, the OG, the original ethnoburb, because it reached an Asian majority by the early 1990s. And scholars, researchers, pundits, and even many residents themselves consider Monterey Park the original ethnoburb, the first suburban Chinatown. And what happened in Monterey Park was a large concentration of particularly Chinese from Hong Kong and Taiwan settling in during the late 70s, but really in the 1980s. And from there, you start to see this kind of mushrooming of, if you will, of Asian American communities surrounding Monterey Park. It'll extend to Alhambra. It'll extend to San Gabriel, Rosemead, Temple City on the west side of the San Gabriel Valley. And it would kind of pretty much jump eastward to more outer ring suburbs of LA.
And so as that migration began in the 70s and 80s into those ethnoburbs, who exactly are we talking about? I mean, was there a class question here amongst Asian Americans that might reflect the change in who immigrated into the U.S. before and after the 1965 Immigration Reform Act, which, you know, opened the door to more people from Asian countries?
Well, in the 1980s, a lot of the Asian residents who moved into Monterey Park were largely from Hong Kong and Taiwan. Many of them were middle class or affluent, and they landed what is often called white collar jobs, right? In business, the medical field, engineering, and so forth. The class difference is stark compared to their pre-1965 counterparts, who many of them were oftentimes agricultural workers, working in the service industry. And so Monterey Park quickly garnered a reputation as, you know, the place you want to be if you are an Asian immigrant of a certain class background with certain means. As the 1980s and 1990s carried on, there were other suburbs surrounding Monterey Park that became more fashionable. These were, by the way, suburbs that for many years were majority white and many of them quite well-to-do, right? And seen as rich communities for even white Americans. So the incomes and, you know, if you will, privileges that came with higher incomes allowed them to enter spaces that were otherwise not open to them a couple decades prior.
How were they received?
With resistance, oftentimes. you know, some residents were open to having Asian immigrants so long as they assimilated or attempted to assimilate or demonstrate gestures towards assimilation. So in other words, for example, not speaking Chinese in public. And the imposition is largely not necessarily just the cultural aspects, but also, again, because of the aesthetic. There were, again, now more Chinese supermarkets and businesses, Chinese signage that was not understood by non-Chinese speakers. It became a battle zone. And temperatures eventually cooled down and residents reached accord in some ways. But there were definitely a lot of moments of hostility and also a lot of moments of learning and a genuine interest in trying to understand each other.
As I gather, the folks who were moving to the neighborhood were moving as home buyers. And I wonder what were they seeking in that regard? Like, as home buyers moving to these places, what is it they were looking for, you think?
It sounds very romanticized and cliche, but they're searching for the suburban American dream. And that suburban American dream includes a single family home. It includes a nice car. It includes a stable career. It includes family life and all of the trappings of suburbia. And not just live there, but own there. And really, again, creating this idea that they have established themselves in a country that, for a lot of people, is the promised land.
And let me ask you a tough question here, too, because when we talk about the suburbs and the movement to the suburbs, it's impossible for me not to think about white flight in general and all of its versions. And I just wonder, like, how much of what you're describing was also white flight amongst a certain class of Asian Americans from the inner city communities that were largely Black, Mexican, and lower income Asian American. Is that a fair comparison? Does that even apply here?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways I want to respond to that. The first thing is that, and this is going back to a question about class, and so the earlier pre-1965 generation oftentimes relied on the urban enclave of Chinatown or historic Filipino town or, you know, other neighborhoods across the United States because they didn't have the income and means to suburbanize, right? That's also coupled with the fact that before the civil rights movement, they couldn't even fathom or think about or even dream about the possibility of moving to the suburbs, right? The other aspect that I want us to consider is that, yes, white folks also left these suburbs with the increase of non-white residents, particularly immigrants, particularly Asians. For some, it was out of prejudice. But for some, it was for them, at least in their eyes, they believed that the amount of change that occurred and quite rapidly was too much for them to take. And it's not necessarily to apologize or condone their behavior and their decisions to leave, but it's a way of trying to understand why they felt that that amount of change was too hard to wrap their heads around. And again, you know, one can easily infer from that 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 is racial, right? And in some cases, in many ways, yes, it was. But for some of them, it was more like there's a type of suburban landscape I'm used to that I'm not feeling anymore, and I need to go somewhere else to find that, right?
It's interesting because the whole idea of the suburbs, well, one of the ideas of suburbs is I'm not here to be challenged.
Right, like, exactly.
This is comfortable, and now you're challenging me with this diversity stuff.
Right,
and that's
exactly.
That's not what I signed up for.
Right, and a lot of it too, right? And the range of reactions was anywhere between wanting to include Asian Americans in particular, or on the other extreme, vilifying them. But a lot of people were somewhere in the middle, right? Caught in this moral dilemma. And in the context of the 80s and 90s, there was, again, for a lot of Americans, including white Americans, an openness or at least a willingness to see what this multiracial American could look like. And it's that moment in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s where a lot of these suburbs became battlegrounds around race and racial inclusion and change and diversity.
I'm talking with historian James Zarza-Diaz about the story of Monterey Park, California. Coming up, what it means that this awful violence occurred in this place of all places.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
We, of course, have since the Monterey Park shooting had yet another mass shooting in Half Moon Bay in Northern California, also involving a shooter of Chinese descent. In this case, the victims are not also Asian American, but I just taken together these stories. I wonder about the emotional toll in general on the Asian American community, particularly the Chinese American community, given all that we've heard over the last few years about people who just feel newly uncertain and unsafe in their communities.
Absolutely. You know, these two tragedies, back to back, during and around Lunar New Year, it's tough to process. And a lot of folks, myself included, who identify as Asian American are still going through the motions. Why this is has been disturbing, why what's occurred over the last few days has been disturbing is because for a lot of Asian Americans since 2020, news of violence towards the Asian American community has become commonplace. And that's not to say it was never there prior to 2020, but the volume, the frequency is why a lot of us feel constant grief, trauma, and fear. When we read those headlines and get the news alerts, we often assume that the perpetrator or perpetrators were doing this as an act of anti-Asian violence, right? In these two cases, we don't know the motives. That's still being investigated. Both perpetrators are of Asian descent. And that's where the story gets a little tricky. I think that's partly why in these two examples, specifically with Monterey Park and Half Moon Bay, Asian Americans especially are like, what is happening here? And that's a broader conversation too to have around the debates around gun control, but also mental health. I can go down that road on and on and within the community with Asian Americans and how we address mental health. So that's why I think a lot of us are still trying to make sense of, you know, why these perpetrators did what they did, but also what does it mean when the perpetrator is quote unquote one of their own?
There is a real conversation in many communities of color about how we handle our mental health and all of the strain. What do you think about the role of mental health in the community in general? Not necessarily applying it to these shootings,
but
how that has come up for you in the last couple of weeks.
This has come up more anecdotally and more just kind of casually amongst family and friends who've been, you know, we've been talking about what's occurred. And for a lot of Asian Americans, particularly immigrants and refugees, not wanting to address, maybe not confronting or maybe minimizing trauma and grief and anything in that universe of feelings. Mm-hmm. And because of that onslaught, you know, there's questions of how do I manage this? Where do I go? Can I go somewhere? Should I go somewhere? What do people think about seeking out mental health resources and support? I can go on and on. I know that a lot of communities of color struggle with that question as well. But the broader feeling is for a lot of Asian Americans, we want to find some joy. We want to find some relief. And we also need to have a more frank discussion across racial lines about caring for our communities and thinking through about how we grapple with trauma, including ones that were racially motivated, but also ones that weren't, right? So this is just a way to think through. I want us to kind of think through, you know, where do we go from here? For Asian Americans, we're sorting that out. And right now, it's just a matter of trying to process all of these examples of terrible and tragic news during what is otherwise supposed to be a happy, joyous time. And I think that's especially why it's been painful and a grueling process.
Indeed.
James Zarzadias is a professor of history at the University of San Francisco and author of Resisting Change in Suburbia, Asian Immigrants and Frontier Nostalgia in LA. Thank you so much for this, James.
Thank you so much.
Notes from America is a production of WNYC Studios. You can follow us wherever you get your podcasts and on Instagram at Notes with Kai. Music and mixing by Jared Paul. Matthew Mirando is our live engineer. Reporting, producing, and editing by Karen Frillman, Vanessa Handy, Regina Dahir, Rahima Nassa, Kushant Navadar, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. And a special welcome to our brand new executive producer, Andre Robert Lee. I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for spending this time with us.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.